I'm Christopher Purdy, pleased to welcome you all to All Sides Weekend. Our topic today is books with my three favorite book mavens and panelists here today, beginning with WOSU's book critic Cassie Rose, whose wonderful blog is so wonderful I'm going to ask you to give the name.
It's thelongestchapter.com.
Bill Eichenberger is also a book blogger and book critic, and his blog is thebooksurf.com. Is that right?
That is.
And to give us class, Kevin Griffith, the professor of poetry and English at Capital University, are all here together. We're going to begin the conversation talking about some of the goodie bags my friends bring with them, stacks of books, and then we're going to ask for your calls and like to hear from you about what you are reading, what you are interested in. Cassie Rose has a stack right in front of me, so I'm going to begin with you. What do you got for us?
I'm going to start with a book that kept me up till about 1 or 2 o'clock this morning reading it. It's called The Personal History of Rachel Dupree, and it's by Anne Weisgarber. It's coming out in about 2 weeks. And it has all of the trappings of a potential bestseller just by the way that the publisher is handling it, and also by the unique story that is here about an African-American family that is pioneering the West. It is the early 1900s, and they take advantage of African-American couple takes advantage of the Homesteading Act of 1862, whereby an individual could get 160 acres of land if they pay a fee and then move out west and farm the land and have to do it for about 1, 2, or 3 years, and then they own it. And so they go to the Badlands of South Dakota. And the book opens in the middle of a drought, and they've been there for 15 years, and they are lowering their 6-year-old daughter down a well to scoop water into the bucket. And it's very Willa Cather. It's beautifully written in terms of the atmosphere of the, you know, the dust, the grit, the wide open sky, the wide open prairie, the hardworking Americanism of, you know, building the home. And of course, there's the twist in the viewpoint here is that, again, it's the African Americans who are out here. It's narrated by the wife, the mother, Rachel Dupree, and it's the prose is easy, it's light, this is not a heavy book, and it's immediately involving. And the author does a very good job also of going backward into explaining how the couple met in Chicago and how they came to come out to the Badlands, which basically Rachel makes a deal with her husband Isaac, who is really of a better family than she is, and she says that he can have her 160 acres if he marries her.
Tell me, what do you know about the author? Is this a first-time author for you, or is this someone who's written other novels that you've known about? Or
no, this is her first novel, wow. And she's from Kettering, Ohio.
I'm not kidding.
So
her name
outside
again?
Of Dayton, Anne Weisgarber. She doesn't live in Dayton anymore. I think she teaches in Texas, I think. And the book has an interesting history, too, in that it was long listed for the Orange Prize. And the Orange Prize is an international prize for women's novels. It's based in London. And it also has for women's first novel, so it has two segments of it. So it was long listed, along with a book by Toni Morrison and several other, you know, very strong and rooted authors. And also it was shortlisted for the Orange Prize in Debut Women Novelists. The Orange Prize is probably, it's on the level of, I don't know if our Pulitzer, but certainly our Pulitzer, our National Book Awards or whatever. So that's a pretty strong statement. So here it was long listed and shortlisted for this prestigious prize before it was published. I'm not quite sure how that happened.
Somebody has a savvy marketer behind them.
Yes.
Good and Rolodex.
Yes, I think yes, so, yeah. Because it's not scheduled to come out till about August 12th.
It's called The Personal History of Rachel Dupree.
Yes.
Bill Eichenberger, yes.
Well, I just read a book that shows how thousands and thousands of acres in the Badlands came to be available for homesteading.
Oh,
it's called Bloodshed at Little Bighorn. And it's about Custer's Last Stand and Sitting Bull. And it's part of Johns Hopkins University's Eyewitness to History series. And these are wonderful series, and I think it's a wonderful way to tell history, which is through quotations from all of the participants on every side. And you realize that even if – that no one side – you can't say, oh, the whites were all this, because Mark Twain was vehemently opposed to the way that that Native Americans were treated. But at the same time, you know, Walt Whitman writes a poem where he's talking about the Indian ambush of Custer. And it's really a trick to ambush somebody who's actually riding into your camp and That's shooting right. at your children and women. But it's by Tim Lehman, a professor at Rocky Mountain College and historian. And it's just a really interesting – and now there's new archaeological information. We now know more, according to Tim, about the battle at Little Bighorn than we did 120 years ago. So there's new information in that way, and then there's a new context with quotes from all the participants, the Cheyenne, the Sioux, Custer, people who liked Custer, people who hated him, all that kind of stuff. So it's a really terrific little book. It's a thin volume. It's a great primer.
Tell me the title again.
It's called Bloodshed at Little Bighorn, and it's by Tim Lehman.
I know the three of you read all the time or you wouldn't be here, but do you read more in the summer?
I do.
Or different in the summer, Cassie, yes?
I do. I have like four books going right now, and one of them is War and Peace, literally.
So, are you blogging on that, on your journey through War and Peace?
I need to start to do that because it's difficult to work that into one's reading schedule. But I don't know what it is. I just keep picking up. I want different types of books. I want maybe a literary novel, and then I'm also wanting a nonfiction, something that I'm going to be – and I read that in the morning with a cup of coffee. The windows are open. It has to do with the rhythm of the day, of the summer day.
And parenthetically, one thing that you told me recently is you actually did kill your television.
I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Intentionally
did.
Or just by accident?
I did, and it was actually a year ago.
How's it been for the year? That's a blog post too, by the way. My year without television.
Yes, it's been very interesting, and when we went to digital, I carried my TV down to the basement and covered it up with a sheet and just said, "All right, that's it," because I didn't want to go through all the complications of getting the box or hooking it up. And what's most interesting is the reactions of people. And
I'm shocked. In a great way. I mean, I'm envious. I would never have the nerve to do it, but I think it's wonderful.
I mean, most people think that it's like I'm going without food, and it gets this dead silence. And the telemarketers too, AT&T Universal, are calling me, and because I have AT&T, and I was doing something with my phone, and of course they said, "Well,
you need a bundle."
Yes. And so they started going that path, and I just said, "Well, I don't have a TV set," and there was just dead silence, and she just said, "Okay."
That shut her up, didn't it? Yes,
yeah. It did. But I find that it's been very freeing. That's all I have to say. And that is one of the reasons why I am reading more.
And Kevin, not only are you a teacher and a poet, you're also a reader, and your children are readers, I happen to know. So what have you killed your television, and what's being read in your house now?
Well, that's an interesting story because we have only one TV. I have three children. We have only one TV. We rarely watch it. It's very small. But for a while, we didn't have any TV, and the reaction was the same. We were called by A.C. Nielsen one time to do one of those Nielsen polls on our TV watching habits, and my wife said, "Well, we don't have a TV." They just said, "Oh, we're so sorry."
I'm
like, no, this is a personal choice on our part.
Like, they didn't know what to do.
We're not wallowing in filth here or anything. We made a choice not to have a TV.
We have an email about this from someone who just now emailed in saying, "I romanticize life without TV, but I'm not brave enough to do it." I'm not brave enough either, Tyler. I absolutely agree with you, but I am very envious of that. So what are you reading?
Well,
Dr.
what I have, this is really interesting. Cassie and I were talking about this beforehand, and this is amazing, such a work of serendipity, because I went to the public library. I picked up this book called Some Things That Meant the World to Me by a writer named Joshua Moore. I was really attracted to the book design, and it was just a great novel. And the publisher is a publisher called $2 Radio. So I thought, this is great. And then I realized $2 Radio is located right here in Ohio, in Granville, Cassie was telling me. So I went and picked up Joshua Moore's next novel called Termite Parade, which is very good. Not quite as good as Some Things That Meant the World to Me, but he has an incredible voice, an incredible handling of character. This is just basically is about three characters, and one, it begins with a pretty traumatic scene of husband carrying his wife up the steps, but he accidentally drops her down the steps. And then there's some questions of whether he did actually drop her. It's a fantastic novel. And this is just, it's great to see that there are people still trying to make it in publishing and producing great novels. And what's also fantastic about this novel is they're actually using some snippets from Cassie's reviews on WOSU as their blurbs.
As well they should.
So that's great. So you look in the back and it says WOSU book and WOSU, a wake-up call, a shouting Bradfield's humorously erudite take. So that's great. People are out there listening, and I feel really good that our show in Cassidy is helping small presses like this. So this is Termite Parade by Joshua Moore. Very, very big on this press.
It seems to be the era now of small presses. They seem to have come back. Am I right about that? That's an impression I'm getting. That small presses are maybe because the economy is so lousy, people are risking less with small presses, but they're doing great stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and I think a lot of authors are going to the small presses because the larger presses have become so political, so monetary based, so and the whole ebook and whatever, that they're losing sight of the quality of the work and working one-on-one with the author and their intent. And $2 Radio is very focused on what their mission is, and it's a great press that has just wonderful not only connections, but it's, you know, they know what they're doing. They have a purpose. They have a mission. They're probably getting tons of manuscripts like any publisher would, yet they are consistently, you know, choosing a certain type of book. It's dark. It's gritty. It's unique.
It's original.
It's original. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's the word.
Yeah. You have a book called The Trade, Bill Eichenberger, in front of you. That's a big book that may be coming from a small press. I'm not sure. But what can you tell us about The Trade?
The Trade, and I always preface what's after a preface when you say – it's a book about –
The show. The show is after the preface.
It's a book about the fur trade in Canada and the Hudson Bay Company. It's a novel, a historical novel. It begins in 1820 and takes the trade through the 1840s. And then I always say, after I say that it's a lot more interesting than it might sound. It's a love story. It's a story about capitalism run amok. It's a story of class cultures. And it's gorgeously written. It's one of the best written books, and it's right up there alongside another of my favorite writers, Canadian writer Wayne Johnston, and his prose is just absolutely – and it's by Fred Stenson. And it's a big, fat, good summer book. You get lost in it.
It's a good read.
Yeah, you're completely transported. And it is a small – it's Douglas and McIntyre. It's a small – well, not small. I mean, they're bigger in Canada, but it's a Canadian press.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a break for 1 minute and come back and continue to talk about books with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. I'm Christopher Purdy, and we'll want your phone calls and your emails. We'll want to know what you're reading back in 1 minute.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered.
Teen violence appears to be spreading through Columbus streets. Mayor Michael Coleman is frustrated that young people are in the crossfire.
Far too many guns are being made available. We're a gun state.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides Weekend. 75 degrees in downtown Columbus currently. Sunshine today, a beautiful day and a high of 82. A few clouds tonight and a low of 62.
Support for WOSU comes from Global Gallery, a nonprofit featuring fair trade coffee and handcrafts from around the world in the Short North at Easton and in Clintonville Commons on North High Street. Information at globalgalleryonline.org.
All Sides Weekend continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We are back for the book edition of All Sides Weekend with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. We were talking about some of the books our friends bring with them when they come in here. We have had an email from Tom, who is enjoying very much a book called The Passage by Justin Cronin. Does that ring a bell with anybody?
Oh, yeah. We were just talking about that beforehand.
Well, he's a big fan of this book. I don't know what you know about it, but we'll put it out there.
I'll go with that.
You want to go ahead? Tom sent a very nice email, so let's see.
It's a very nice email, and I would wonder, Tom, what did you see in that book? Because I'm not a big fan of The Passage. I was really interested in the whole backstory and hype surrounding The Passage. It's a huge novel about a plague that turns people into kind of sort of vampires and how, you know, society deals with that. And the author, who is actually a writer of literary merit, got a huge advance, $3.4 million for that novel. Mm-hmm. So I ordered it and read about the first 70 pages, and I couldn't believe it. It was just ponderous, pretentious. I think he's really worried about his reputation, or he wants to make sure everybody understands he's a real literary writer. So there's like Shakespearean references and quotes all throughout it. And ultimately, though, it's just a very boring book, I thought. So, Tom, I would recommend – I have an alternative to The Passage. This book, in spite of its rather gruesome cover – is called Hater by David Moody. If there are other The Passage haters out there, you should read Hater by David Moody, which is an extremely well-written novel about a plague and how a father and his children deal with this plague. That's a plague that turns people and it gets people enraged for just unknown reasons, and they just turn on people and how society deals with that. It's very well-written. So that's my thoughts on The Passage.
I think this is an example, too, I mean, where we were just talking about the small presses versus the large publishers. And, I mean, the story behind this is that he was riding his bicycle with his son. He was running, and his son was riding his bicycle beside him, and they were concocting this futuristic story. And then he decided to write it. And anyway, one thing leads to the next, and he's on the Today Show, and he's getting, you know, huge publicity for this book, and it has vampires and all this in it, and it's, you know, showcased in all the bookstores. And whether or not it's quality, I don't know.
For the record, Bill Eichenberger loves The Passage. I want to give the phone number, 614-292-8513, 614-292-8513. You can also send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like to know what you're reading, what you suggest. Maybe you'd like to have some recommendations as well. I'm going to put it out there, if you don't mind. I'm going to we're talking about Stieg Larsson, the Swedish writer, whose novel, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and its two sequels are all the rage now. And I picked it up because it was in the New York Times. It was on every TV show. It was everywhere. And I read the first one, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and liked it, but don't really get why it's the sort of book of the age. Can anybody enlighten me on this one?
I've not read it. I didn't go down that path.
Oh, yes, you have. You just no. Well, I read it, and I thought it was very good, and enjoyed it, and I'm glad I read it. But now there are literary tours all through the sites in Sweden that are sold out 6 months in advance. I think it's going to be a Brangelina movie, or it's going to be a big Hollywood production, and really. The sales have been phenomenal for Stieg Larsson's book. May he rest in peace. Apparently, he passed away young, and good for him. But again, I'm not getting it from all the hype. I'm just not.
Are you going to go on and read the next two books? Then,
it's waiting for me at the Whetstone Library as we speak. To answer your question, yes, because I'm trying to get with the program.
You're a completist here.
I am. Yes, I'm a completist. Yes. Yes.
I'll step out on a limb here, and I haven't read The Passage, so I don't endorse it. But I think that the closer that a book is to a movie, and the less of a real reading experience it can be, the more popular it's likely to become. And I'll point to someone like Stieg Larsson probably, or Dan Brown. People no longer care that every other sentence has a cliche in it, or whether or not something is written well as opposed to awkwardly. And that's a kind of reading, but it's just not ultimately rewarding. And I think people should probably have slightly higher standards when it comes to these, top of the bestseller list books.
But this is a Swedish book. This is a book that took off first in Europe.
Yeah.
And my experience is that European books and bestsellers specifically are not necessarily bestsellers here. So that one is a unique situation for a European book being
to translate over. Yeah.
We don't cross the pond in terms of, you know, bestsellers, which has been fascinating for me because I have read some of their bestsellers and waited for them to become something here, and they're not. Mm-hmm. So what is it about this book that became a bestseller here? And is it a certain quality of writing, Christopher, for you?
It's a thriller. It has a lot of, I guess, timely ingredients in the pot. It's a high-tech based thriller. There's a lot of very complicated computer hacking going on. There's a missing dead body who's not, well, I won't give it away. But I'm just saying, I mean, all the elements seem to be there. But really, I mean, you know that this book and this series has really gone global in a huge way very quickly. And again, I liked it. It was fine. But I'm not seeing I'm not obsessing like some people apparently are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of Swedish mystery writers, and I've been reading them for a long time. And as I've said here before in this program, I'm a big fan of Henning Mankell, who wrote the Kurt Wallander series. I highly recommend those. And I feel kind of bad for Henning Mankell that Stieg Larsson's getting all of what could have been his. And I can say, just from my experiences reading Henning Mankell, is that Swedish fiction tends to be darker, tends to be more introspective, at least his. I don't know if that's the case with Stieg Larsson. And it focuses more on the detective and the inner mind state of the detective. And my favorite scenes in the Kurt Wallander mysteries aren't him hunting down a killer, but him sitting like watching his laundry go in the dryer with nothing to do and wondering what's a 50-year-old man going to do with his life. And, you know, it's very introspective, mm-hmm. you know, Bergman-like, things like that I really like. And the prose, they're very good prose stylists in Sweden. Mm-hmm. They have a very clean style. They know how to put two sentences together, so that's why I like Mankell.
Well, I don't begrudge anybody their success. I'm just wondering why. But anyway, 292-8513 or allsides@wosu.org. That's how you get in touch with us right now to let us know what you're reading. Cassie Rose, before we went on the air, you were mentioning that the Allen Ginsberg's great poem Howl is about to be made into a movie. And you brought some Jack Kerouac and Ginsberg with you as well.
Yes, it's actually... It's the story of the movie is about the story about Howl and its publishing history. It came out in 1957 and was deemed to be obscene. And the publisher, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and his bookstore manager from City Lights in San Francisco were arrested on obscenity charges. And it went to court. The literati showed up and basically said this is not obscene literature. It is socially relevant. So the movie is about that, and there's a great trailer for it. And I have written about it on the current post of my blog. If you scroll down just a little bit and you see you'll see the cover of the graphic novel Howl. Right next to it at the end of the paragraph is a link to the trailer, the movie trailer. And the Don Draper from Mad Men is one of the...
John Hamm,
is
the current stud muffin of the world, apparently. Yeah. So I'm told.
So they're publishing Howl as a graphic novel or a graphic poem, you could say, as a tie-in to the movie. This graphic iteration is coming out the end of this month, and they say it's illustrated. Every stanza is illustrated by Eric. It's a New Yorker illustrator, Eric Drucker. You'll recognize his style if you get The New Yorker and see because of the cover. He does many of the covers. So it's a very, I'm looking forward to it. And one of the things that I say in my blog is that I have a little bit of a problem of classics being turned into graphic novels because I think it's an easy read. Mm-hmm. Although, and then I go on to admit I'm looking forward to reading Howl and I did not ever read it in its original. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, it's a graphic novel coming out.
You're probably too nice to read Howl.
Good morning.
Well,
unlike some of us.
It looks well, and if I read the graphic and then I watch the movie here in Columbus is not going to arrive till November.
Okay.
But it's something to watch for.
But you brought us a volume of letters between Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, and that's fascinating to me.
It's a fascinating book. It was published this month, and this is the book that I am reading in the mornings. I love to read letters, but these letters are one of the best because they wrote frequently to each other in the late 1940s, in the 1950s. They wrote about what they thought about society, what they thought about each other, how they were dealing with their day-to-day life. Allen Ginsberg going into the Nut House, you know, Kerouac being implicated in a murder charge. And they lived intensely. They lived fully. And you get that in the letters. And there are some – there are beautiful lines in it, too. And if I can take a second and just read one short one. Like, here's an example of what they'll say. Jack Kerouac is writing to Ginsberg, and he says, "Alan, life ain't worth the candle. We all know it. And almost everything is wrong. But there's nothing we can do about it. And living is heaven." And that just summarizes the way that
wish
they
you were here.
launched into every day. It's a terrific collection of letters that are very rich in the way that they live their lives.
Do you get the sense that they write these letters for posterity, or is it more immediate and visceral than that? Because on the one hand, you have to know you're a pretty good writer and that something's going on, and yet on the other hand, they seem very personal and
they are very personal, but they did see themselves as writers writing to each other.
Both of them sure did. Kerouac sure did. He knew he was going to be a writer from the word go. It's really interesting. I'm really interested in that Howell's going to be made into a movie. I was just reading the facsimile manuscript of Howell yesterday, ironically or coincidentally. And it's interesting to read the letters. There are some letters from Ginsberg to other people there, too, and one of them's really funny. He's writing this letter to someone, and he says, you know, well, I just published my first book, Howell, and it's coming out in an edition of 1,000 copies. It'll probably do nothing. I have nothing to worry about.
You know? And he went to jail. It was a huge thing. 50 years later, and here we sit talking about it. Yeah. One thing, because two of you are blogging, and you're teaching, and you're people of influence, and people follow what you say about books. How do you choose a book to write about or teach about? Bill, on your blog, what has to happen for you to want to really blog about a book and get into it and share it?
Well, now it's just because it's my blog. It's basically things that I find interesting, and that's the beginning and end of it. I mean, it really is authors that I want to talk to. It's pretty much exclusively Q&A, and I just want to know more about a book I've read, and I talk to the authors and put it up at the site, and that's pretty much the way it goes.
How about you, Cassie?
One of the things I think that I try and do with a blog that is to bring forth a lot of the books that I read about and that I read that I don't review. And they're the books along the way that I find from reading all sorts of publications, and I want to get mentioned. And it's from books that are published across the pond, books that are published here. It may be also an old book or something that I come across. There was one, for example, David Jones in Parenthesis. It's a book that was published in the 1930s. T.S. Eliot said it was a work of genius. It's a combination of poetry and prose. And it's that kind of book that I don't really have a way to talk about it on the radio, but on the blog I can put it out there and help to guide people to books that they may find interesting that, again, that aren't going to be on the book tables in the bookstores, because there are so many books that we can choose from, and people who are not exposed to all the publications that we are here don't have that wide array to choose from. And so I want to just pull out as many books as I can that they may not be seeing in the bookstores to help them make choices.
Kevin, I know when you're teaching, you probably have to teach a specific pantheon of books, but I suspect that you are very interesting about what you choose to teach that might be outside that box a little bit.
One of the things, I'm lucky that where I teach, I get a lot of freedom in what I can use in a class. And of course, when you teach creative writing textbooks are usually abysmal, so I don't use those. So I try to find things that I think would be really interesting to students and really different and fresh. And I always tell my students, you know, I won't make you read anything that I wouldn't read for pleasure and enjoyment, and that I think is truly great literature. It's interesting. I brought along a book by a writer who I've used in creative writing before, Stephen Dobbins, and I've used his book of short stories. He has a book of short stories called Eating Naked, which he published about 10 years ago. And I use that in class because each of those stories was a lesson in how to write a short story. That's the best way you learn how to write, read great models. And I can't believe it's been a long, hard search, but I finally found a really great book of poetry, and it's his latest book of poetry, Stephen Dobbins. He's an interesting guy. He's written 10 novels. He writes genre fiction. He's written horror fiction, but he's also written 10 books of poetry, and this one's called Winter's Journey. And he's 70 years old now, and I love this book because he pulls no punches in this book. It's like he finally decided, I'm going to abandon all pretense and just say what I feel. And it's kind of like Nicholson Baker's The Anthologist. If he had written a book of poetry, he just says what he thinks about other poets, about the state of poetry, about politics in general. I highly recommend it. But Stephen Dobbins I've used in class many times because he's just such an excellent writer, and he crosses all sorts of different genres too.
Well, I thought Flannery O'Connor wrote an interesting essay about – or maybe it was in an interview, but she said that – ours is the first generation of adults who asks the children what they will allow us to teach them. And I wonder, I mean, you know, when you come to being a teacher, there is that line, though, between something that the kids will find completely mystifying and not relate to at all and still informing them and teaching them rather than letting them kind of who's wagging the dog's tail.
Yeah, you know? That's right. That's interesting because it's hard to tell because I know for a fact that if I let my students pick what we read, we'd either be reading Harry Potter. It's amazing. Even
Eclipse.
Adolescents who are 18 or 19 still read Harry Potter.
I'm sure people are writing doctoral dissertations on Harry Potter. I'm sure they are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or you know, on the other side, William S. Burroughs and all the Beat stuff, you know, that kind of thing. So it's really good to introduce them to things that outside of their comfort zone. That's what I like to do.
Well, they probably don't have the wide field of choice. So if you would leave them to make their choices, I mean, they don't have from experience the, you know, the wide field of what's out there.
No, they don't. And it's interesting, you know, when you become a teenager and you begin to hit those college years, they haven't read a lot. They haven't been out there reading novels. Mm-hmm. Or if they do read, they tend to read Harry Potter or Jeff Lindsay. They read the Dexter novels. I've seen them do that. Or, you know, pretty much straightforward genre fiction. They don't know that much about literary fiction at all. That's just not taught in the schools or contemporary literary fiction.
Right. I stress to my younger colleagues in this building who are having their children now, read to your children, which I know you all do. Absolutely read to your children. That's how in my family, she became such a voracious reader because she was read to before she could walk. And I throw that out there for what it's worth, but read to your children. We've got to take a break. We're going to be back in 90 seconds with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. 292-8513, all sides at WOSU.org. I'm Christopher Purdy, back in 90 seconds.
On the next Fresh Air, we add one more tribute to Daniel Schorr, who continued to be an NPR news analyst until a few weeks before his death last week. We'll listen back to the interview we recorded in 1994 on the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. We talked about Schorr's CBS coverage of Watergate and his run-ins with CBS and the Nixon administration. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. You're a continuous listener to WOSU, so be a continuous supporter by becoming a sustaining member today. As a sustaining member, your gift automatically renews. Give $20, $50, or $100 a month, and your sustaining membership will also help keep on-air fundraising to a minimum. To become a sustaining member, visit WOSU.org/sustainer. And thank you for your support of WOSU Public Media. It's 75 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:39. Sunshine today, a beautiful day expected with a high of 82. A few clouds tonight, a low of 62 degrees. Morning sunshine for Saturday, a few clouds in the afternoon, and a slight chance of rain, but just a 20% chance, a high of 82 degrees. All Sides Weekend continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
We are back. I'm Christopher Purdy. We're talking about books. We'll be with you for another 19 minutes or so, 292-8513 or all sides at WOSU.org. Because I have you three experts here, and I'm certainly not in your league, I like to throw something out when we get together when a long-established writer is discovered for the first time. I always knew who Carson McCullers was, but I last week read The Heart is a Lonely Hunter for the first time and fell absolutely in love and was enthralled by this book. It was like, you know, eating the best steak in the world and being that energized. So talk to me, first of all, about her. She's been dead for 40-plus years, and she died rather young, and about really finding an author everybody sort of knows but doesn't really read anymore.
Boy, Carson McCullers, that was her first book.
Yeah.
And it was a breakout bestseller, and she was in her early 20s. I started to read a little bit more about her this past week, and because I have a book by her called The Clock Without Hands, which was one of her later books, which was not reviewed well. But the way it's positioned on my bookcase, I was walking out the door one day, and it was like her eyes looking at me through the bookcase was like,
hey, book critic,
yes,
I got one for you.
I got one for you. And I had been thinking lately, and I put that picture on my blog too, because there was something about it that was just really, I don't know.
And I didn't know that about you. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Because I've been wanting to reread The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. Something about, because I read it when I was in college, in a college lit class, but I wonder if I would read it differently now.
Well, I mean, I turned every two pages and just, it was just, the word beautiful was the only word that really came to mind about the prose there. And there's no plot per se, really. It's like a summer in the life of this family where everything goes haywire. And it's incredible.
I have this fantasy of having been alive when the great library at Alexandria was in existence and where it was possible for a human being to walk into the library and essentially after years and years or decades to read every book that had ever been written. Mm. That's so far. There's a book called So Many Books or something. It was a very small little book.
Harold Bloom, isn't it?
No, it's Zaid, I think is the guy's name. I can't remember. It was on Paul Dry Books. It was a small, but the guy's talking about, I mean, how many hundreds of thousands, millions of books that are published, you know, every year almost. And you can get lost, and then you come back to someone like Carson McCullers, who, like you say, you've heard about, and it just can blow you away. Mm-hmm. And I think I would recommend, because we talk a lot about how do you find books or what to read next, and I would say to steer away from things that might be at the top of the bestseller list and or steer away from, you know, sort of prescribed book lists and find your own way. Read books to find, you know, and
what
read what
love.
Authors say to about who the authors they love and go back or do what Kevin does. I love it. He just goes into the library and he's got an eye for it and he comes away with stuff that he absolutely loves and is completely surprised by.
That's what happened to me with Carson McCullers. I was in the library in the M's and I saw it and I said, well, I know that. I know who she is, but I've never read it and grabbed it. We have an email from a listener. My 13-year-old daughter turned me on to the Gallagher Girls series by Ali Carter. It's her guilty pleasure that she's passing on to friends. Do you know about this series? Well, write
that
down because I love guilty pleasures, so I'm delighted to have that email. Again, the Gallagher Girls series by Ali Carter. We thank you very much. And we have a call from Jerry who wants to talk about a book called War is a Racket. Hello, Jerry. Are you there?
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you very much. Wonderful program.
Thank you.
I'm an old curmudgeon, so...
you're in good company. Come on.
I read only nonfiction. I've had enough fantasies in my 80-some years of life. But this book was written by Marine General Smedley Butler, War is a Racket, 70-some years ago. And in that book, he's quoted as saying, why don't those oil companies have their own flag to put on their own personal property?
Wow.
Perhaps one with a gasoline pump on it.
Wow.
I was in the Navy. My friend of mine who was in the Marines told me about this book a number of years ago. And I wasn't thinking anything about it until we were coming back from a family reunion in southwestern Missouri in 06. And I heard this woman on the radio talking about it. I said, by gosh, I got to stop at Barnes & Noble and get a copy of that. Well, they looked it up. They said, well, first editions are $200. Wait a minute.
It's my God-made libraries.
Yeah. It was reissued by the Butler family in 2003. I got one, a small book, $9.95. I said, get me one, and I got it. And this man not only won 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, he had the guts to tell things like it is. War is a racket.
And
he also was a whistleblower. I don't know if you gentlemen ladies know about the attempted coup directed by General George Van Mosley. Oh, gosh, I'm trying to think of his last name. Retired major general who lived in the old Biltmore Hotel drinking mint juleps in Atlanta, Georgia, and he wanted to overthrow FDR. And the guy they were thinking of putting in as whatever you want to call it, emperor, whoever, was Douglas MacArthur.
Oh, well.
Now, you're not going to read much about this.
No, I should say not.
Because, but I would highly recommend that to anybody who thinks that war is something. I just heard on the radio yesterday that some of these young fellows are just going baga over war. Well, I've been in, and let me tell you, General Sherman was right. And you want to look at the whole quote. But this book, War is a Racket, and I got to call my Marine friend today because I know his health isn't the greatest. We're all getting older, but as George Burns says, just don't get old.
Jerry, thank you so much for the recommendation. I've written down that title for myself. I appreciate the call. Thank you so much for that. We have an email from Shauna, who has read 2 books that were both features on NPR, Nonfiction, Priceless, and Tokyo Vice. Ringing a bell with anybody? Recommendations from Shauna, Priceless and Tokyo Vice, fascinating and eye-opening reading. And she writes in also, since you brought up vampire novels earlier, I have a couple of fun reads, Blood Oath and Necroscope by Brian Lumley. So for all you vampires and their friends out there, Blood Oath and Brian Lumley, we thank you very much, Shauna. Thank you, Jerry, for your call. 292-8513, allsides@wosu.org. Kevin Griffith, do you have something else in your pile for us today?
Well, I was going to say real quickly, one of the things when we talked about how do you go about getting books and how do you go about getting off the beaten path with books, I wanted to give credit where credit's due. One of the most helpful things to me is when I go to the Whetstone Library, the end caps where the librarians recommend books. Yeah. They have them there, and they have the bookmarks.
Right. Yes.
And thank you to Earlene, whoever Earlene is, because Earlene really knows how to pick them.
I'm going to look for Earlene.
I have a really crazy book that was picked by one of the Whetstone librarians. This is an amazing book. It looks like an auction catalog, but what it really is it was the authors made up an auction of personal items of this couple who has broken up. And there's a little story about each of the items and how it contributed to the breakup. And kind of a heartbreaking look at how a relationship goes bad through just people's material possessions. And the title is, get ready, it's called Important Artifacts and Personal Property from the Collection of Leonor Doolin and Harold Morris, Including Books, Street Fashion, and Jewelry. And it's so just remember important artifacts and personal property.
But you never know what's going to catch your eye and what you're going to find in any kind of library.
And those librarians are great there. That's fantastic.
292-8513. Let me turn to – what are you blogging about recently, Bill Eichenberger? Who are you talking to on your blog?
I just put up a couple of days ago an interview with Tim Lehman, the historian who's the author of Bloodshed at Little Bighorn. And I've got several more in the works right now.
But. And I know everything is going to be at WOSU.org, but just for giggles, give us the blog address again.
See, you asked too fast. www.thebooksurf.blogspot.com.
Okay, and that's Bill Eichenberger's blog. And Cassie Rose, what's recent with you on your blog?
Well, one of the things that I posted recently was about the 2010 Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, which is announced in September, but they announced the short list in the beginning of the summer. And what's neat about it is that it comes out of Cork, Ireland, which is where Frank O'Connor was born, and it really does celebrate the short story. And this year, there are 5 U.S. writers who are on the short list. And you can find that on thelongestchapter.com. And it is a great – what I positioned it as is it's a great way to find a short story collection because, you know, short stories are a mainstay of the publishing community, but they're not the money makers, and they don't get pushed by the publishers. And, you know, there used to be – in Frank O'Connor's time, it was a heyday of short stories published in magazines, and you could be a short story writer and be right up there with the novelists. And now it's – I think being a short story writer is looked more as a launch pad to being a novelist.
But back in those days, I mean, there were such – there were so many great literary magazines available for a nickel. I would think nowadays with the web it would be easier to be a short story writer, but I – maybe not. No? Kevin's shaking his head no.
No, I just think I remember one time you had Don Pollock on the radio, yeah. And I did an interview with Don Pollock for a magazine, and you know, his first short story collection, Knockemstiff, was fantastic. But
it was indeed.
You know, he's writing a novel now, and yeah. He said at that time, he said, you know, the worst novel will outsell the best book of short stories. And I just think
true.
That's where it is.
That's something I should have asked him when he was here. Is he sort of going against his heart writing?
Yeah,
a novel
that's right.
Two of my favorite books of the last 20 years that I read were the complete short stories of Updike and also Bernard Malamud, mm-hmm. and they're 1,000 pages long. Yeah. I mean, imagine a career where you could write 1,000 pages worth of short stories, mm-hmm. and it just doesn't. You won't see that anymore.
Well, and I think part of the problem, and this is what I wrote a little bit about in the blog post, was that there are a lot of literary magazines out there. There are hundreds of them, mm-hmm. but they are getting inundated with short stories mm-hmm. from all the writers coming out of the writing workshops. But they're not buying the literary magazines. So a literary magazine will publish maybe 1,500 copies of one of their magazines, and they're inundated by thousands of mm-hmm. writers who aren't supporting the literary magazines.
Well, and you have Flannery O'Connor having once said that being asked the question, do writing workshops and creative writing mm-hmm. programs stifle writers? And she said, I don't think they stifle enough of them.
Well, now, true to fashion, now that we're in the last 7 minutes of the show, we have three people on hold waiting to talk to us. Let's go and see what Ed has to say. Ed, hello. Are you there?
Yes. I just finished The Last Stand by Nathaniel Philbrick. It's a very good written book about Custer's battle, and it contrasts the life of Custer and Sitting Bull and actually takes it beyond that to Sitting Bull's demise years later. Well-researched, there's 300-some pages, but it's got about 100 pages of notes plus a bibliography. One of the note pages, for instance, says notes to pages 44 to 46, and included in it is where he actually thanks someone for giving him the Springfield carbine and the military pistol that the officers would have used so he could get an idea of how it would shoot and deepen his understanding of what they might have gone through in that battle. And it's a very well-written book, good maps, and I would highly recommend it to anybody that wants to know a lot more about that than we get in the popular press.
Last Stand by Nathaniel Philbrick. Thank you so much, Ed, for the call. I know when Ed mentioned that, both of your heads were nodding. You were all sort of nodding in recognition about that. We have a call from Don, who wants to talk about Carson McCullers, who was once roommates with Benjamin Britten in Brooklyn, I think it was, which sounds like the name of a TV show. Don, hello. Are you there?
Hey, this is Don.
Hi.
Recommending February House, the story of W.H. Auden, Carson McCullers, Jane and Powell Bowles, Benjamin Britten, and a friend of mine, Gypsy Rose Lee.
Wow.
Under One Roof in Wartime America by Cheryl Tippins. Recommended reading.
Wow.
Don, you've got to write your memoirs just because, I mean, I know you. We won't go into it on the air, but you've got to write the story of your life as well. Thank you. February House, thank you, Don, very much for that recommendation. I happen to know that this was in a boarding house in Brooklyn Heights during the Second World War, and people like Virgil Thompson lived there, and it was wild.
Wow.
It was apparently we can't really discuss on the radio what went on in that house, but I am going to get February House the minute we get off the air here. 292-8513, all sides at WOSU.org. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. We are talking about books with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffiths. Bill Eichenberger is a book blogger and book critic. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. And Kevin is professor of English at Capital University and is here to give us class. And we have a call from Anne about one of the things Anne wants to discuss is turning off her TV. Hello, Anne. Anne, are you there?
AM. Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
Yes, we turned off our TV, pulled the plug when our daughter was 13, many, many years ago, and it was the best thing we did. Now, giving up radio would be another issue.
don't do that.
Don't ever do that.
I want to second Jerry's nomination of War is a Racket. It's a small book, quick read, but very heavy and very potent in terms of what it talks about. I like to use my summer rereading some books, as Cassie spoke about, rereading things I read when I was younger, and now from a different perspective, it certainly makes a difference. And I am now rereading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich,
which
I read at 14, and obviously did not really take in everything. And now from this perspective, in my mid-70s, is an amazing book to reread.
I can't wait to reread that. I read that when I was 17, and there's no book like it, really, that
Absolutely. It's so powerful.
That must be a very absorbing book. That sounds like it would probably be a summer project for
it
you.
Is.
Yeah, yeah.
It is. It's definitely not a quick read. You certainly have to take it in doses and let it sink in.
Now, you said that you turned off the TV when your daughter was 13. Is that right?
Yes.
I have to ask you what her reaction to that was.
Actually, she did not. We actually did it as a family agreement.
Wow.
She loved to read.
Oh,
and draw. And she actually said, well, she wasn't really, didn't care about it.
You probably read to her when she was a baby, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
In the womb.
But you didn't have to pay her or anything. You didn't have to pay her or bribe her to turn off the TV. That's terrific.
Very good. None at all.
And thank you so much for your call. Thank you.
Thank you for your show.
Thank you. 292-8513. We have 2 minutes left. Everybody waits. God love you to the last 10 minutes. But we get great calls, and I'm delighted. Thank you so much. The email is also allsides@wosu.org. In our last 2 minutes, I want to ask each of you for sort of a last recommendation until we meet again in August. Kevin, what do you got for us?
One great novel I read, again, I just stumbled over it on the new book section at the library. It's called The Thieves of Manhattan by Adam Langer. It's a great comic novel about the publishing industry. There's some great jokes about the publishing industry and how bad it's become and how they won't publish fiction anymore. Everything has to be nonfiction. And so this the protagonist in the novel tries to write a fictional story and pass it off as nonfiction. Very good. The Thieves of Manhattan, Adam Langer.
Cassie Rose, what do you have for us?
I would recommend for people to take a look at Girl by the Road at Night by David, I don't know if it's Rabe or Rabi, R-A-B-E.
The playwright, David Rabe.
Rabe. Yeah. This is his first novel, and like many of his plays, it is set in Vietnam about a young man who goes over and meets a Vietnamese girl, and it's about their relationship, and it's a very good book, and it's gotten some great reviews.
His plays include The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel, which is a very powerful Vietnam-era play. He's also married to Jill Clayburgh. That's People Magazine. Tell me the title again.
It's Girl by the Road at Night.
By David Rabe. And Bill, what do you have for us?
A book by Bill Barich called A Fine Place to Daydream. It's subtitled Racehorses, Romance, and the Irish. And Bill Barich had thought he was going to retire to some trout stream in the West.
We all think that, yeah.
And ended up in Ireland falling in love with horse racing there. And it's utterly unlike horse racing here. They do steeplechases. They do 3 and 4 mile races. We only do really one. 1.5 is the most we do. But he talks about – and he also falls in love with a woman there. And so it's an intermixture of how they conduct racing in Ireland, how passionate they are about horse racing, and then also about his deep and profound new love. And he's just a terrific writer. He said he can only handicap races while drinking a pint of Guinness. So he's really a man after my own heart.
In our last minute, very quickly, what do you think we're going to be talking about a month from now? Anything new and exciting in the pipe that you think we're going to be really hearing about or talking about? Or is it going to be the continuation of Stieg Larsson? God bless him.
We'll talk next month about what's coming up in the fall. There's all kinds of really exciting. V.S. Naipaul has a new book out. Lewis Hyde has a new book coming out in August.
Julia Glass has a new book coming out.
Yeah. We'll look forward to that. My thanks to Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you for listening. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.